Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Chris Mason, journalist and presenter for BBC News. Starting his career as a trainee at ITN in 2001, he left for BBC Newcastle a year later before becoming a political reporter for BBC Five Live. And save for a two-year stint in Brussels as Europe correspondent, he's focused solely on Westminster for the last 15 years across radio, TV and online. He also presents Newscast, the BBC show which started life as the hugely successful Brexit cast in 2017. And in 2019, he was named as the new host of Radio 4's Any Questions. Chris, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That's an incredible career already for a fellow Yorkshireman.
It sounded like someone else actually hearing that biography.
You have the career, as I told you just before we started, you have the career I always wanted as a child.
Well, the curious thing is, it's interesting when you hear someone, particularly someone like you as a listener of your podcast, actually read out, you know, sort of my professional biography and we're face to face for the first time. The oddity is when you hear it like that, and it's all accurate, by the way, so I'm not going to pick you up on any factual inaccuracies. But of course, you hear sort of 20 years crunched into a couple of sentences. And of course, day by day, it's all a very gradual process. And also, not only is it a gradual process, but like with any career, firstly, it's only vaguely planned. And secondly, it has sort of about turns and cul-de-sacs out of which you might reverse. Whereas when you look at it in the sort of macro, when you look back at it, it all looks sort of very linear, very planned and
like
very
sequential.
Exactly.
You know, staircase.
Exactly. And of course, it's much more higgledy-piggledy.
With huge pitfalls on the way for me.
Oh, me too, completely. And it constant internal questions about whether you've made the right move, whether you're good enough, whether it's all about to go pear-shaped. Oh, that happens all the time.
I get that a bit as well. And it's surprising how many people at the quote-unquote the top get imposter syndrome as well. I mean, you were quite open about it when you first went on the BBC Breakfast sofa.
Oh, God, yeah. I've had loads of moments of imposter syndrome. But I suppose as you get older, and this is about life as well as journalism or any line of work, you get fewer properly first-time moments. Because even when something is the first time, it'll be similar to something else you've done. And when a couple of years ago, nearly 3 years ago now, I sat on the breakfast sofa as a presenter for the first time, my goodness. I mean, instantly I was taken back in a way that I'd forgotten to what it was like the very first time I broadcast on the BBC and the very first time I broadcast ever. And I remember the first time I broadcast on the BBC. I was in Newcastle, as you were saying. I was sitting in the studio opposite Francesca Williams, the presenter, and I had to talk about a village in the northeast of England in County Durham called Towlaw. Happens to be where Mark Knopfler is originally from.
Oh, some Dire Straits.
Yeah. Anyway, I can't remember what the story was, but Towlaw is a place, believe you me, that you can mispronounce in multiple ways. I think I'm right in saying it is spelled T-A-W-L-A-W. So the law bit's fairly doable, but
Ali, who writes these intros for me,
you know,
she'll put, if it's in double brackets, that means she's deliberately written it phonetically, because we get some usual named people.
And my goodness, of course, so I went in there, it's Towlaw, I think I said Towlaw, made a complete hash of it. What I've since learnt with pronunciations is that the ones you double check, you get right, and the ones that you don't are the ones you get wrong. So a couple of weeks ago on Any Questions, we were in Aberdeen, and somebody put in a name that was sort of Gaelic, basically. And one of my Scottish colleagues reckoned that it might be an elaborate Mickey take to make an English idiot look like an English idiot. And so we didn't actually select this particular question. And we selected somebody else with what seemed like a far more pronounceable name.
Yes.
And I introduced them. Now, we'll take our first question from, and I can't remember the name, but the surname I pronounced wrong. And it was one of those classics that you check something that looks like it needs checking. You don't check the thing that you think doesn't need checking, and it's that trips you up.
So, isn't it amazing, though, as a journalist, that you have to be mindful that people are out to trip you up?
I mean, to be fair, this person may not have been out to trip me up, but somebody who knew more, vastly more than I did about Scotland and Scottish politics had a suspicion. And that was enough for me to think, you know what, I don't think I'll take that question. I suppose it's the equivalent of, you know, the texter who claims to be called IP Knightley or
yes.
Ivor Biggin or, you know, yeah. All those kind of ones.
All the fake names that Bart used to use when he'd ring Mo, the bartender.
Exactly. And I know from presenting on Five Live and elsewhere that people are People are always trying to have a go at that. And why not? I mean, you know, life's too short to be too po-faced about these things. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to be a butt of a joke too often. So, that actually was a reminder, that whole experience of always double-checking. And double-checking the things that you don't think you need to double-check, because they're the ones that will trip you up.
So you must have an amazing lifestyle at the moment. I mean, and all-encompassing. I mean, it's taken you 20 years, but you've become an overnight success. You're everywhere.
Yeah, and you know, the great joy of it is, you know, the BBC is this incredible toy box of broadcasting. It's the biggest broadcasting toy box, certainly in the UK, and it's one of the biggest in the world, certainly within news. And that's a joy for someone like me. I get very easily bored. So to have this incredible array of toys that you can play with, whether it be, you know, being a political correspondent, which I do 3 days a week, presenting Any Questions, which I do 1 day a week, presenting BBC Breakfast whenever I can fit it in, presenting elsewhere on 5 Live or Radio 4 or the World Service, again, when I can fit it in, it's a joy. But going back to the imposter syndrome, by the way, sitting on that sofa for the first time, my goodness. I just was thinking, what on earth am I doing here? I'd never read from an auto cue before. I'd never had open talk back where you have an earpiece in and you can hear the constant jabbering of the gallery, which I thought would be a nightmare, but was actually very reassuring. And I'd never presented on the TV before. And the curiosity is, about 10 days earlier, I'd been called in by Breakfast then editor, lovely guy called Adam Bullimore. And he'd texted me and said, give us a ring or pop in when you next have a moment. And I thought I was getting called in for a ticking off, because I'd been on his programme a few days before from the Tory conference in Manchester, just down the road from Salford. And Theresa May had been on doing that morning round where she's doing the interviews. And I was doing the thing where, you know, the politician does the interview and then the political correspondent comes on afterwards and does the whole, well, what does all this all mean? And what have we learnt that we didn't previously know?
Not a lot with Theresa May, yeah.
Well, exactly that. So I was sat there listening to this interview and Louise Minchin was doing her best. But Theresa May was doing one of those interviews that Theresa May did rather a lot of, where, you know, love or hate Theresa May, she could do an interview where she didn't say a great deal. Now, sometimes that can be a skill for a politician, but you're the viewer's advocate as the person summing it up. And my goodness, it was heavy going. And I
That's
said,
why she lost.
And I said off the back of this, I thought, what do I say? And I said, live off the back of it, I said something like, Louise, you know, and I didn't want to be disparaging about Louise because she genuinely tried to do a good interview. I wouldn't have done a better interview. I'd have done probably a far, far worse interview. But I said, with the best will in the world, that's 10 minutes of our lives we're not going to get back.
It's good, isn't it?
And after I said it, it's not a particularly original line, but after I said it and then I came off the air, I thought, was that a bit harsh? I mean, you know, she's the Prime Minister. It's hard to run the country. She's not coming on as an entertainer. And she has a duty to answer the questions. Yeah, which I suppose she did. She just didn't tell us a great deal. And you know, and that's her prerogative. But I thought, you know, maybe Adam has concluded that, you know, that's not really the done thing and all the rest of it. So I was convinced when I went in to see him that I was going to get a rollicking. So I went in and I had a sort of in my head, I sort of had a plan about, well, this is where I'll concede. You know, maybe the language was a bit harsh, but the general sentiment about, ultimately, I don't think it was an interview where we learnt a great deal, was my professional judgment. Was the nature of that interview. Anyway, I went in there thinking, you know, that's what I'll say. And then he said, I'm thinking of trying you out as a presenter. What? I said, you do realise that I've never presented on the TV before.
It probably makes you ideally qualified these days.
And he said, no, I was aware of that. And I said, well, yeah. I said, of course I'd like to give it a go. In the same way that, you know, if the England manager phoned me up and said, do you want to play centre forward? I'd say yes, but I might also say, as a fan of the England team and a fan of the programme, it may not actually be in your best interest to pick me. And he said, no, I think we should, give you a go. He said, there's no point doing dry runs and all the rest of it because, you know, you're a broadcaster every day. There's no point doing dry runs.
Why would there be?
You know, you just need to go on and do it. And I said, right, yeah, fine. And then this was in October, about 3 years ago. And I thought, well, this is all fine. You know, isn't this lovely? And, you know, maybe I'll get a couple of cover shifts next August. Yeah. And then he said, what are you doing next Sunday? What? Yeah. What? And so, you know, fast forward a week, and there I am, 6:02, Sunday morning. I've been to makeup. I mean, makeup's a whole experience in itself. It's sitting in makeup. I mean, I would feel, if I went into a makeup place without a professional, I would feel more confident stepping onto the flight deck of a Boeing jumbo jet and trying to get it off the ground than I would going into a makeup room unaided and being told to sort of dip the brush in a potion. And anyway, so you go through all that experience. These makeup staff are geniuses.
I mean, a lot of broadcasting.
You know, they can make me look almost plausible.
I used to leave the makeup on after I left.
I do.
Because you look $1 million.
You just absolutely look
like a flawless version of you with some vibrancy in life.
Exactly. I've never looked more alive. Yeah. I get colour in my cheeks and stuff. As though you're looking my usual pasty Yorkshire self.
Because viewers don't know why you need makeup, really. It's because the lights are so bright that if you don't, you have makeup to look normal again under the lights.
You do. But then there's an additional twist, which is the curse of modern technology, which is HD. Mm. I mean, HD is terrible. It's great if you're a viewer, but it's no good if you're actually on because, you know, it is nothing. You know, I'm all for going back to the black and white days where, you know, all sorts of, you know, foibles, physical foibles that we all have and I have in abundance would be masked by the mediocre technology of the time. Now with Ultra HD and all the rest of it, my
even 4K,
goodness.
Yeah, as you say, yeah, it's horrendous.
Widescreen and all the rest of it. I mean, you know, you've got to make sure that your socks match and all this kind of stuff. You've got to iron your shirt. You've got to, you know, buy a comb. All these technical equipment that you need on the telly. But those moments of imposter syndrome. You know, that moment doing breakfast TV for the first time.
Reading an auto cue is hard. I mean, as you just found out there, even just reading the intro, I'm all right having a conversation with you now, but reading an intro, we have to get the cadences right and all of this kind of stuff. And the intro's written for me. Mm. So I've had a look at it beforehand, but I haven't really practiced it aloud. I haven't got time. I run a business. So it's difficult to know when to go up and when to go down. And if it's live, you've got no way of going back to it.
I think that's right. And what I, the curiosity with broadcasting, and it goes back to the point you made about makeup, is that all you're aspiring to be when you start out is being who you are the rest of the time. But the oddity with broadcasting is that because when you first do it, sitting in front of a microphone is odd, wearing headphones is odd, staring into a metal box, which happens to be a camera, is odd. We all become this sort of weird caricature where, you know, you sort of... Your posture is as if you've still got the coat hanger in the back of your jacket. You start speaking in a sort of tone and with cadences that don't quite work. You can have sing-song delivery. And reading a script takes, in my experience, it takes years to be able to read a script in a way that makes it sound like you're not reading a script.
Agreed.
Air miles. So I'm a massive believer, massive, massive believer. I say this to young journalists when they're starting out, that it's all about air miles. Because there's one of the most toxic words in broadcasting, in my view. And sometimes it's used ironically, and when it's used ironically, it's fine. But one of the most toxic words is the word talent to describe people who are on the air. Because it assumes that you've either got it or you haven't. Mm. And I just don't buy that because, you know, somewhere, thankfully, I started broadcasting in the pre sort of YouTube era, but, you know, I've got tapes somewhere of when I first started broadcasting, and my goodness, I was dire. And why was I dire? I'd never done it before. Mm. Since then, I've got hours
dire.
And hours. Yeah, you're less dire. Every year, I aspire that my sort of worst outings in that year were better than the worst outings of the year before. Because you're only as good as your last broadcast and you oscillate. You can have great shows or great lives or great reports and then duff ones. But you hope that the average gets better over time or that the poorest gets better over time. And it does because you just practice and you get more comfortable sitting in front of these things and talking and becoming basically yourself plus probably about 10%, a slightly better version of yourself. But fundamentally, the best broadcasters, the people who I sort of most admire, are those who are fundamentally the same person on air as off.
Because we were discussing that actually before the podcast starts, that I've had quite a few guests here that are slightly different, shall I say, when the microphone's live and they're different off air. Not evil versions of themselves like you might think, but just less on, less vivacious, less, and I've had that with a few times where I've actually been like, now I've just met you, but we also had a good chat beforehand, and I can tell you the same off air as you were on. But I've had a few ones where I've been late or whatever, we've gone straight into it, and then afterwards they've been completely different after the microphone's been switched off.
Yeah, and there's a subtlety there because some people, I do think you do have to, you know, broadcasting is a performance, and you are performing, and in that sense, I do think you have to be sort of yourself plus 10%, but you shouldn't be yourself plus 70% because then you're not being yourself, really. And you've got to be authentic. And with the amount of live broadcasting that we all do now, if you're not authentic, you're going to get found out. I mean, in fact, I don't even think you can be realistically now a sort of daily broadcaster and not be yourself. Because if you're doing the amount, certainly the amount of output that I'm doing, because, well, you just have to be an actor. But and that'd be a bit weird.
But that's the bit I find incredibly admirable about what you do, is you've got to be someone who can almost talk about anything. You've got to know the subject so well that you can be called on air at short notice. I mean, David Sillitoe came on here a couple of years ago.
Oh, and he's brilliant.
David's a legend, and he's from our neck of the woods as
he
well,
is,
of course.
Isn't he? Yeah.
And he was saying that he was out in his garden one Sunday afternoon, and the phone went, and it was some producer, and they said, oh, this person's died, and then we'll just connect you now. And he thought he was being put through to some producer or whatever. And then it was like an anchor back from that, it might have been Stephen Cole or someone, and said, so we're now joined by David Sillitoe, who's got blah blah, blah. This person's died. And he suddenly thought, have they not had the courtesy to tell me that I'm about to go on air? Do they assume I know that? And he thought, I'm actually on air now. And then he could, obviously it'll be some static picture of him on the phone.
Taken 20 years ago.
In the 80s.
Probably in a Bermuda, shirt or something totally inappropriate to the gravity of what he's talking about.
And he didn't even know this person had died until like literally a second and a half before, and then suddenly he's on air saying, well, you know, this is going to go down badly and wherever. And I just thought, wow, that's incredible. I mean, because you have so much output now. You've got what was Brexit Cast, Newscast, Any Questions. You've got to be across all of it. When do you find time to actually get the news yourself?
I suppose it's constantly reading. So you've got to do a huge amount of reading. And then constantly, I've just come from Parliament where I was meeting a shadow front bencher and before that a cabinet minister. So constantly speaking to people off the record privately to try and understand what's going on. But then sometimes it's luck. So a couple of years ago, I was asked to update the obituaries for Tony Benn. And I did those and they hadn't been rewritten for about 10 years. And I did them. I went to go and meet him and all the rest of it, and did all these things. And you think to yourself when you're doing these things, well, often they'll never see the light of day, because if the person in question lives for quite a lot longer, which you kind of hope with anyone they will, then the obit will be out of date and somebody else will update it. Anyway, about 6 months later, I was stood in Downing Street one morning doing some lives about whatever. And at 7:02, when I was plugged in and about to go on and talk about whatever it was, PA, the Press Association, snapped on their wire, Tony Benn has died. And thankfully, because I'd done this obituary, I was able to say to the gallery, right, put me on live now and I'll just talk. Because I had it all in my head. Now, I had it in my head because I'd done it relatively recently. I didn't have the scripts on me, but I had enough to be able to just talk. And I was one of those moments, this is rare, but I almost impressed myself with how much I managed to recall. But it was complete luck. Why was it luck? It was luck that I was on shift at the moment that it happened. I mean, this sounds awful because you're ultimately reporting about someone's death. But journalistically, it was very fortunate because there was the coincidence of me being on air at that time, in front of a camera at that time because I was going to go on and talk about something else, and having recently updated this incredibly important political figure's obituary. And then having the responsibility, and it's one of the biggest responsibilities in political journalism, I always think, when you find yourself having to reflect on somebody's life. Mm. Because there's no right to reply. There's no kind of, it's not a story that is going to sort of disappear. It's a big moment where you have
the potential for offence as well.
Oh, it's massive, of course.
What happens if you forgot some key achievement as well, innocently?
Completely. Oh, completely. And you're trying to do it in a dispassionate, impartial, journalistic way. But you're also conscious that members of his family or their family, whoever it might be, could be turning on and hearing this. Some of them, more distant family, might actually be hearing the news from you for the first time. So the gravity of getting it right tonally, factually, in context is huge. But the kind of sense of achievement, and this accounts for any kind of journalism or any kind of reporting, any kind of broadcasting, of telling a good story well. When people say to me, what ultimately are you in the business of doing? Telling good stories well. That's what I want to do every day. Now, in reality, journalistically, you spend a lot of time telling mediocre stories. Now, you hope you tell mediocre stories well, and you hope you tell duff stories well as well. The worst offence in journalism is telling a good story badly. That's what makes me wince when I'm watching or listening or reading. When you think, that is a really good story and you've not told it well. That's really bad. Yeah, bad stories told badly, you won't even get to the bottom, the end of, because you just, who cares about the story and it's been told badly. Telling a good story well is so satisfying when you think, I've really communicated that well, it's written well, or you've just got to the essence of it. That's what it's all about. And there's no greater and more satisfying feeling in my line of work, presenting or reporting, than telling a good story well.
And to what extent is it a personality game? I mean, obviously there was Samir Ahmed's recent issue with the Tribunal, where they were saying Jeremy Vine is, you know, worth X more because, you know, his bigger viewers and so on. I mean, I don't want to make it about them personally, but ultimately it is. People have to decide whether they like you on air. Mm. You've got to be trusted by all. It's not just about your ability to tell the story, but also they're making an assessment as you as a person. Is Hugh Edwards more liked because people connect with him better? Is that his humanity or is it his journalism?
So for me, it is about personality. And I think we should be sort of unabashed about that, really. Of course, it's the story that matters. You're in the business of communicating the story. But we're broadcast journalists. Mm. Maybe we will one day be overtaken by AI and some sort of computer-generated voice that manages to broadcast the news and write it in a wonderfully connective and immersive and relatable way.
I always thought Terminator 2 was a good news story. I look forward to welcoming our robot overlords.
But I kind of think, to an extent, we're heading... There are some items now. I think I'm right in saying
Sports
there are some items
business,
on the BBC News website that are written by some computer that, you know, basic assembly of the facts that does it. But I kind of think my view has always been in broadcast journalism that, of course, the story is king, but we're human beings communicating the story. And therefore, of course, we're personalities. And if we're not personalities, then why should we triumph over the AI, really? So I'm fairly unabashed of the view that, of course, this is about being a personality and that is part of the whole business of communicating the news or communicating any kind of form of media, any kind of broadcasting comes down to the power of the broadcaster and their capacity to get stuff across. And that's the same if you're Ken Bruce on Radio 2 or you're Hugh Edwards on the 10 o'clock news or you're anything in between. It's all about connecting with an audience. That's what unites brilliant broadcasters. I don't include myself on the same, anywhere near the same kind of summit to which the likes of Ken and Hugh have reached. But what unites those two? Plenty of people would say, well, nothing, because, you know, one is a news anchor and the other is a Radio 2 presenter. They're both in the business of connecting with audiences and communicating with audiences and finding the right language to ensure that whatever it is they are saying sticks in the mind of the person listening or watching. So a vast amount connects them. And I think a big part of that is the individual. A vast amount of that is about the individual because the listener, the viewer, has a connection with them.
Some of the journalists I've admired over the years, you can kind of tell just from their intonation whether they respect their interviewer. I'm thinking of John Humphreys, Eddie Mair, you know, even Andrew Neil. The way that they would even ask a question, you would think, this guy thinks the minister's a dick. And then you think, well, he is. He's probably telling a fib. You know, how do you do that when you... Do you deliberately try to not load the question? I mean, one of the... Again, this is turning into the Hugh Edwards fan club, but one of the things I really admire about Hugh is he's like what I would call a proper news anchor. Like, I genuinely don't know what his view is on X, Y, and Z. And that's what I want. That's why I trust his journalism.
Totally. So I think that's absolutely key. I go back to my first day as a trainee at ITN. And about a dozen of us were taken into a basement kind of conference room of Gray's Inn Road. I was so excited. The kind of Yorkshire kid who'd come to London. I'd only been to London once before.
I remember my first time in the basement there. Channel 4 News Studio used to be there in the basement.
Yeah. And IRN, the Independent Radio News, were there. LBC were there. News Direct, which was on 97.3, the London frequency for LBC now. Anyway, we went down there and... And I was so excited because one of the massive influences on me as a teenager was ITN's News at 10 in the Trevor MacDonald era. I just thought that it was a wonderful communicator of news, sort of diamond hard news, popularly told.
One of the best interviewees I've ever had was Sir Trevor. He was amazing.
I just thought that bulletin was absolutely superb in its heyday then. Anyway, so there I am as an ITN trainee, beyond excited about being there. And this senior executive said, hauled us into a room and said, congratulations. And we all thought it was kind of congratulations on getting on this traineeship. He said, congratulations, you've all pulled through your opinionectomy operation. Now, of course, all of us in broadcast journalism come with our own baggage and our own background and our own prejudices. But that idea that the fundamental at the heart of British broadcast journalism, this isn't a BBC point because ITN and Sky are bound by the same conventions and the same regulation about due impartiality, is so important. So for me, it's the sort of absolute non-negotiable. I don't want anyone at work to have any idea what I might think. Actually, the reality is, I don't even really think about what I think. All I think about is the story. What's the story? What's the question that the listener or the viewer wants asking? What's the absolute essence of this? And then just reverence of the facts. That's all that really matters. I admire people in politics. So I often say to people, I like politicians. And people will say, particularly in this era of kind of anti-politician, people will say, oh, you know, why would you do that? Aren't they all, you know, snouts in the trap?
Rogues, Romans, snouts in the trap. Throwbacks.
I say, no, I think it's admirable. I think it's admirable to put yourself up for election when there's a likelihood that you might not win, or that even if you're in a safe seat, your party might get sick of you and turf you out. And also,
that was the guy I stood against in 2005. I stood in Rydale. I was Labour's candidate in the strong Tory seat of, right. Of Rydale. Pickering, Kirby Moore side. You know the area well, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was John Greenaway.
Oh, yes.
And
he
obviously beat me soundly. And then they deselected him within a few years because he'd had an affair.
Right. And this is the thing. You know, even in a very safe seat, either the seat will no longer be safe or your local party might turf you out.
Well, that's what I realised about our democracy. Of course, in safe seats, it's only about 50 or 60 people that truly have the choice, the power in that seat. Because whoever they choose to be the Tory candidate is going to get in.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think what's interesting is that even in the period since then, what would be regarded as a safe seat. So there was a whole generation of Labour MPs in Scotland who might have reasonably assumed they had a job for life, who then didn't because the political tide changed and the SNP and the Tories won loads of seats. So I kind of admire people. I admire people who go into politics. I admire people who stand for public office. I admire people who hold views when they are fashionable and then when they're unfashionable or the opposite. Equally, I admire politicians who are willing to say that they've changed their mind. I hate that phrase, the U-turn, that journalists love, because it implies that to change your mind is a bad idea.
Well, strong leadership is about deciding at the beginning what you're going to do and then never thinking of anything else.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we should point out when somebody has changed their mind. But I don't think it's our job to assume that is therefore a bad thing. They've presumably, on the basis of some evidence, you can argue all day whether that evidence is, in your view, sufficient that they've changed their mind, but that's for the viewer to decide, the listener to decide. But, you know, just point out that they've changed their view and their argument for changing their view is X. But for me, journalistically, it's just all about being the observer. And I don't want anyone to have the faintest idea about what I may or may not think. I give what I think barely any time anyway, because I'm just interested in telling the story. And then it's about how you tell the story in the best way possible, trying to find sources of humour. The great joy of politics. Political stories, most of the time, if you think of the spectrum of news as being like a strip of paper from 0 to 100, where 0 is the most serious, grave, horrendous story you can imagine, and 100 is a sort of, you know, the skateboarding squirrel. Politics,
good
most
story, though.
Absolutely. I know, terrific. I love those stories. Politics, most of the time, occupies the mushy 60% in the middle. Not the 20% of the hardest, grimmest news, court cases or, you know, crime stories or whatever, and not the most ludicrous, daft stories, although sometimes it ventures into that and sometimes it ventures into the hard stuff. Most of the time, it's in that mushy 60%. The mushy 60% are the hardest stories to tell because they're the ones that don't have the, in journalistic terms, the most sort of, well, they're less sexy, bluntly. So they require good storytelling, but also they're not, most of the time, life and death. And therefore, if you can find sources of humour, find them. So one of my obsessions, and I keep going on and on and on about this, and it's certainly what I'm trying to do with any questions, and I do with all of, I think, I try and do with all of my presenting, is that I think for much of the history of British broadcasting, and certainly the BBC, in my view, there's been an assumption that to be serious is to be formal, that the two things are one and the same thing. And that goes back to, you know, people reading the news in dinner jackets in, you know, 1932.
Although I'd go back to that if it was me personally. Would you? But, well, yeah.
Dear listener, Paul is in an open-necked check shirt.
Yeah, media cliche, yeah.
I think I'm more smartly dressed than you,
you're
actually.
Right. You look $1 million, in fairness.
Very rarely
you
am I
come off air.
Very rarely am I the smartest dressed man in the room. But I think I am today. My kind of view is, you know, you can be serious and informal. Seriously informal. So, you know, and that's not dumbing down. It's absolutely not. You can have seriousness of purpose, be intelligent, be thoughtful, be probing, revere getting involved in esoteric discussions about whatever it might be. But do it in a human way. Talk in a language that sounds like you're having a normal conversation, not that sort of stilted, stuffy, starchy language that I think, bluntly, when I was growing up, and flicked on Radio 4. This is going back 25 years. The network's moved a long way since then. But you know, I flicked on. I only listened to Radio 4 when I was growing up because my mum and dad got a new kitchen put in, and the kitchen lights used to take out the 5 Live signal on medium wave, and it'd turn it into that.
909-693.
Yeah, you'd be like when you drove under a set of, if you drove under a set of pylons on the motorway, you know, and you go under the pylons and miss the goal because you've come out the other side, and you know you've missed Alan Green talking about some 90th minute winner. But I only discovered Radio 4 because of the flipping kitchen lights taking out the medium wave signal of 5 Live, and then you know. I don't know, it just sounded very otherworldly, full of people who didn't sound like me or talk like me or use language like me, and or indeed anyone how I even knew.
But you were talking then earlier about getting the cadences right and the difficulty of reading an auto cue, but it's actually very difficult to do light and shade equally well, and there's very few broadcasters, in my opinion, that can do both well. Jeremy Vine, Nicky Campbell, Rachel Burden, people like that can credibly say some top person's died, and then also say, now here's some gardening tips, and do both well. It's very difficult.
It is, but I think you've got to be willing to do both. So the best example I can think of this, and thankfully the wonderful editor at the time trusted me to do it, a woman called Joanna Carr, who's now head of current affairs for the BBC, and she was the editor of PM when Eddie Mair was the presenter. And I did, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of in the last 10 years alongside Brexitcast, I did a series of desks, they were called election desks and referendum desks, these roundups during the campaigns of the last 5 or 6 years, where every night at 5:30, Eddie and Joe gave me this big chunk, about sometimes 7 minutes, but often 4 or 5 minutes, which in broadcast terms is an age.
It's an epoch.
Yeah. And they basically let me... I mean, they knew what I was going to do with it, but they let me just get on with it. And what I would try and do was a sketch of that day's campaigning. So we would try and touch the serious moments, but we would jump on the daft moments as well. The idea being that it was this sort of benchmark that would pop up every day. I would write it all and edit it all and write it all, get it all distilled down. But it would be done very much in my voice. And it was, as I say, a bit of a sketch. Firstly, I knew it would divide the audience because some would regard it as flippant. But secondly, I thought this is just a great thing to be able to do. And they were wonderfully generous in giving me that sort of time. And Eddie was great at building up this sort of team of voices that he would regularly use on the programme. Superb broadcaster. Anyway, I was doing these in the referendum campaign. And we got about a week shy of the referendum. And I'd done one on, I think, the Wednesday night, Tuesday or Wednesday night. This is the week before polling day. So about 7 or 8 days before polling day. And I'd done this very daft one on the day that there was a flotilla on the Thames involving Bob Geldof and Nigel Farage,
basically shouting
insults into megaphones at one another. You didn't even need to write that in a sketch writer's kind of way. It just wrote itself. It was so absurd. Anyway, I did that. The day after was the day that Joe Cox was murdered. And so I rang up PM and I said, I want to still do the desk. It'll be nothing like it's been.
Well, it
nothing
couldn't have been, like could it? Been,
of course. And it's, without sort of blowing smoke at my own posterior, it's one of the proudest bits of broadcasting I've ever done. Because I thought, I've got to do that thing where the audience will get the contrast. Because they'll get that I've revelled in mucking about in this slot. So I'm going to go from, it's on that spectrum thing again, I'm going to go from one end of the spectrum, I'm going to go from 100 to naught. I'm going to be thoughtful, the pace of it will be massively slower, and it'll surprise the audience because they'll be expecting, oh my goodness, here he is, this Joker Mason, he's going to get the tone wrong, he's going to make a hash of it, and all the rest of it. And being able to do that full spectrum thing really matters. But I kind of think, you know, as broadcasters, and it's what Nicky is so good at, what Jeremy is so good at, Rachel and others, is that, you know, you get that human communication at its best is at all ranges of the spectrum. Mm. Laughter when it's appropriate, tears when they're appropriate, and everything in between. Levity, but then real seriousness. I sort of stand on the shoulders of giants, people like Nicky and Rachel and Eddie and Jeremy, at seeing how they do that, using that full emotional range, and therefore connecting with an audience. That's the essence of it. That's what broadcasting ultimately is all about, because it's a human-to-human connection. Of course it is. Of course it's that. And yet sometimes the conventions of broadcasting and how it's always been done can almost put barriers in the way of that. So it's about that, yeah, human to human communication and getting that human connection. And you sometimes see, and I've had more of this in the last few years than ever before, when, you know, listeners, viewers, then meet you, you know, in the streets and stop you. The weird thing is, actually, Paul, is that what happens most often is that people look at me and do a double take. And sometimes I think I'm maybe just imagining that double take. And sometimes they might be doing a double take at the person over my shoulder who I can't even see.
And what they're thinking is, where do I know that guy?
Yeah,
from?
And then they think, and
was
then
I,
they,
was he our next door neighbour a couple of years ago?
And then
ago?
They think, no, he's that bloke who came and emptied our septic tank last summer, exactly. Wasn't it? That's it. And then on they go.
I've told this anecdote before, and it's a dull anecdote, but I was in York Station a few years ago. There was this bloke coming up to me, and I didn't have my glasses on. And I was agonising over whether to say hello to him. Was he a Lib Dem activist? You know, you think, well, because I had a few political enemies in York back in the day. Was this guy, where do I know him from? As he come up, and I thought, but it'd be rude if I didn't. My mother would be mad at me if I knew this guy and then him and he might be hurt. So I thought, I'm just going to say hello. And I went, oh, hello. And he looked at me as if I was a total alien. And then I realised, oh, that's Alan Titchmarsh from the telly. You do that, but that's the same thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I won't get it anywhere near to the extent that he does. And Paul, but it might ease off for me because Brexit's died down, and so, you know, there is what I do isn't kind of as front and centre as it perhaps was in 2019. But yeah, it's a curious thing. But ultimately, it's the you know, and it's sufficient novelty for me that I kind of revel in it rather than find it difficult. But ultimately, it's the ultimate feedback, because broadcasting is all about talking to people and connecting with people and connecting with as big a number of people as you can, really, because that's broadcasting rather than narrowcasting. Mm. And so when people then talk to you about, oh, I like this or I didn't like that, and my goodness, you know, feedback comes in all sorts of forms, but face to face it always tends to be fairly positive, unlike some corners of social media. So, you know, and that's wonderful, that connection.
But you made reference there to social media, because I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you know, one, politics has gone doolally over the last few years, whatever side you're on. All of the traditional rules have gone. Is that an exciting thing, or is it, you know, there's so much news happening? And then two, as you mentioned about social media, I mean, you know, we had people protesting against Nick Robinson at BBC Scotland, Laura Koonsberg having to have bodyguards. You know, this journalism is under attack as never before, not just from, you know, the members of the public, but also, frankly, from the President of the United States.
I think the interesting thing with social media, so when I first sort of ventured onto Twitter, the reason I went onto Twitter sort of 10 years ago, and this makes me sound like some sort of desperate apprentice candidate, but I thought bluntly that it's a great personal brand builder.
That's the reason why I do it.
That's what motivated me to go on it. But what was really striking was that in the early years, when people were critical, my instinct with social media is to interact, because I think it's social and it's about a conversation. So I've always interacted with people and replied to people. And in the early years, anecdotally, when you replied, most people, if somebody said, oh, I think this was wrong because of X. I mean, sometimes they're right, by the way, because we're all fallible. But sometimes you'd reply and say, well, no, it isn't, because this is why I did this, this and this and whatever. In the early days, the vast majority of people would reply and say, oh, I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting. Anyway, nice to chat. Best wishes, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that was that. In other words, it was a pleasant human interaction. Now, that is incredibly rare. Mm. So people are much more likely to sort of dig in or do a bit of whataboutery and pick something else that they want to have a pop out.
Well, it's even worse. I remember when I stood for Parliament in 2005, Peter Mandelson said to me, in a traditional situation, you'd knock on a voter's door, they'd answer it, and you'd say, vote Labour, you know, here I am. And they'd say, no, I'm not going to vote Labour because of immigration. Traditionally, you'd then try and reason with that person. You'd say, well, actually, immigration's undoubtedly very good for the economy. They're buying your goods and services, blah, blah, blah. You give them the facts, naively assuming that would win them over. Not only have you not won them over, but now they've marked you out as someone who's the enemy. You're one of them, are you? He said to me that all you can do is make them feel heard, and that you shouldn't attempt to reason someone out of a position that they've not reasoned themselves into.
I think the interesting thing about that is, well, firstly, that a big element of politics is about sort of sentiment and the extent to which you trust individuals and sort of messaging as opposed to just sort of facts and arguments. I think the other thing, which I've been really struck by in my own personal experience of social media, and I think this has been much worse for plenty of female colleagues and is often much, much worse for politicians, is the constant impugning of motive.
Yeah.
Oh, you're only saying that because you're X. You know, you're only saying that because of Y. What you really think is this. And you think, you know, and it's it's one thing for a journalist to get it. Much actually harder, I think, for politicians or people with a particular sort of public point of view. Because, you know, they'll be told, oh, you know, you only think X because of Y. As opposed to, you know, it's that whole thing that people have lost the capacity to say, oh, well, you know, a lot of people have lost the capacity to say, oh, well, I disagree with that because of X, Y, and Z.
The whole as opposed never kissed a Tory hashtag and things like that.
As opposed to people saying, you know, you only think that because you're evil type argument, which you see a huge amount of on social media. It's perhaps been magnified by, you know, a very binary argument around Brexit. And then obviously, you know, some influential political figures also being big advocates of social media themselves. But when you then step back from it all, actually, it's a reminder that what really matters in the whole broadcasting game, news broadcasting game, is trust, is being trusted. Now, arguably, there's been this crisis of trust in institutions over the last 10, 15 years. You think of the banks, you think of the press with the Leveson inquiry, you think of, you know, people that, well, every kind of institution has been sort of criticised. And I suppose, you know, part of that is the kind of generation-long collapse of deference. You know, no longer do reporters say, oh, Prime Minister, do you have a word to share with the nation?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So plenty of people would say that a lot of that has been a good thing. You know, I suppose from a journalistic perspective, you know, when there is this constant wall of noise on social media, all you can cling to is the fact that hopefully people trust you. And that's a constant battle. And trust, of course, is easily thrown away and hard to win. But ultimately, journalistically, that's what you have to hope is something worth fighting for and why you hope people come to you.
But does anyone know anything anymore now? I mean, I remember when Theresa May went into the election, I thought, well, that was a very clever move, because if you look at the polls, she's going to get a huge majority. Proved wrong. When Boris called the general election, I thought, well, look at what's happened with Dominic Cummings and all of this kind of thing. He's bound to, this is going to make it even worse, and of course, a huge majority. I used to live in Hampstead many, many years ago, and it was Glenda Jackson's last election, and unusually, it was a three-way marginal. And I didn't like the Tory Chris Philp, who's gone on to a safe seat somewhere else. And Glenda said, you know, Paul, can you vote for me? I've known Glenda for many years. She was my MP. And I said, Glenda, only an idiot would think you'd get elected, re-elected. I think you're a great person, but honestly, you're demeaning your legacy by standing again because you've absolutely no chance. She got elected. I advised Nigel Griffiths. I'm friends with Nigel Griffiths, the former MP for Edinburgh South. I said, Nigel, you need to stand down, mate. You know, it's the only seat we've got left and you're going to lose it. Come on, stand down. A number of his friends advised him to do that. His replacement, who was arguably a bit more than a paper candidate, won.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely gutted.
Yeah.
I mean, does anyone know anything anymore?
No, I don't think we do. And I think we should always be humble about what we don't know. So, funnily enough...
Well, actually, you don't have a clue what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, the oddity is, and the moment, inadvertently... So I had an experience a couple of years ago where I inadvertently went viral. And it was as a result of something where I'd been decided. So this was in November of the year before last, so November 2018. And we were in the midst of all of the Brexit stuff. And what I'd become really frustrated with was the fact that it was very easy to go on the air and sort of set out a plausible case for what might happen. And it'd be plausible because it'd be well thought through and it'd be logical. But in all likelihood, it'd be rubbish. Because there were so many moving parts in terms of what was going on, nobody had a clue what was going to happen. So I decided, I thought, right, when the opportunity arises, I'm going to sort of say this on the air. So there I was, stood on College Green one weekday morning, waiting to chat to Dan and Louise on breakfast. And I was asked about, you know, what's going to happen next, which is kind of always the second or third question that comes to a political correspondent. Perfectly reasonable question to ask. But I concluded that basically, however much you knew about what was happening now, and obviously it's our job as journalists to try and find out, but it's always imperfect because you're an outsider, you're not on the inside. I realised that however much you knew about what was happening now, there was so much that was unknowable about what was going to happen in the future. So I was waiting there to go on, and there was this trail about Mr. Blobby on before me. Anyway, so when I was on the air, I ended up talking about Mr. Blobby.
As you would, as you do.
And of course, when this thing got clipped up and it went viral, people must have assumed that I spent my entire working sort of life obsessing about this pink inflatable 1990s TV creature.
I know you've never denied that.
No, no. whereas in reality, it had just been mentioned on a trail about 2 minutes before. But anyway, I went on the air and said, I haven't got the foggiest idea what's going to happen. Is Theresa May going to get a Brexit deal through Parliament? Don't know. Is she going to survive as Prime Minister? Don't know. Anyway, I just went on this bit of a sort of rant.
It's in my notes here, my briefing. It says you caused an international incident when you said that.
Well, I mean, it did feel like that. Basically, what I discovered was that going viral is a pretty scary experience, even when, broadly speaking, people are liking what you've done. So goodness knows what it must be like when it's some horrific gaffe. So I did this live, and then I just got on with my day. And Breakfast TV clipped it up and put it on social media, but not much happened with it. The day after, I think it was the day after, Guido Fawkes, the political blog, got hold of it, put it out. And I think the Daily Express did as well. And then it just went bonkers. So it got picked up by a professor of journalism at the Columbia Journalism School in the States. Then it ended up on John Oliver's HBO show.
Which is an absolute genius show. I loved last week.
Yeah, and which was just extraordinary. And then it got picked up by Le Parisien. And I got dubbed into French. So Monsieur Blobby was dubbed into French. And the word foggiest, it turns out, doesn't really translate into French when you're not making a meteorological point. So I can't remember what the French word is for foggiest in that context.
Politics doesn't translate well, doesn't it?
So this thing, yeah, so it went totally viral. Now, some people missed the point. Some people assumed that somehow I was admitting to the fact that I didn't, you know, that I was a failure because I didn't
resign.
Know
resign right
on.
Now.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you don't deserve your BBC salary.
What's the point? What's the point of you if you can't tell us exactly what's going to happen?
It's part of the conspiracy.
Yeah. And I said, no, you're missing the point. It doesn't matter how well you are informed you are about the here and now, and I try my best. I'm sure there's people who are more informed, but I try my best. I think it's reasonable. But I've no idea. And you know what? Neither of you, and neither has anybody else.
It's a mark of confidence, because as I was telling you earlier before we started the recording, in the first sort of 6 months of this, sort of 4 or 5 years ago when I started it, if I made a glaring error, I would actually edit it out, because I thought I didn't want my listeners to think he doesn't know what he's talking about. Whereas now, because I've built my confidence up, I leave it in, because actually it's more honest. But also, if I've made that error, and it's like that in big business meetings, there's always one idiot who puts a question and says, what does that acronym stand for? And everyone else is secretly thinking, oh, I'm glad he
completely
asked that, rather
completely
than me, because...
Exactly. And I think, you know, we live in this sort of now, I think, we live in this, going back to the point I was making earlier, this age of informality, where to be honest and authentic is absolutely key, because we live in an age of constant WhatsApp conversations and YouTube videos and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, and the barriers to entry to broadcasting have come down massively with a plethora of podcasts and, you know, online YouTube influencers and all that kind of stuff. So you have to communicate in an honest and open way. And you know what? If you don't know something, and it is reasonable journalistically for you not to know, you should be communicating that to the audience. There's no point trying to claim you know something that is unknowable. I mean, that's absurd.
I agree with you.
And at that point, it was totally unknowable to know what was going to happen. But as I say, the thing that had annoyed me was not only that nobody was willing to say it's unknowable, but the problem was you could always hide behind the plausible case about what might happen. And it was, you know, we all did it. I did it. It's what frustrated me until this point where I just snapped. We do these plausible things about what might happen, which were reasonable. And, you know, and in the old sort of university essay type of scenario, it was a perfectly plausible argument. Oh, yeah, perfectly reasonable, grounded in the facts, you know, citing evidence, citing precedent. It's all fine. But it probably is a load of nonsense.
Probably is.
Because it's just a guess. That's all it is. And so you're telling the viewer this guess. Well, how does that help them? You know, and even
it's an educated guess. It's an informed guess.
It is, but it's a guess. And ultimately, and if it's right, then you are lucky. And if it's wrong, it's useless. Whereas actually, the reason that the story at that time was so compelling was because it was unknowable. That was the crux of it. The crux was it was unknowable. We didn't know how long the government would last, and we didn't know whether the fundamental reason for the government's existence, delivering Brexit, would happen. There are no two bigger questions in politics than those if you don't know the answer to them. And of course, the reason we're now in very different political times, and it's for an individual listener to decide whether you think that's a good or a bad thing, but the reason we're now in very different political times from the ones we were in at the tail end of 2019 is that some of those fundamentals are answerable. Now, as I say, you come to your own judgment of whether you think the answer's a good or a bad thing, but they are answerable. You know, will the government survive the year? Well, the answer is yes, it will. In all likelihood,
it will
you know,
now.
you know, the question of last year, will Brexit happen? Well, it has happened. Now, granted, there's a huge amount of uncertainty about what the future relationship looks like and all the rest of it. But the massive questions of 2019, will the government survive and will Brexit happen? Unanswerable last year, now answered. That's why politics feels different, because there's much less that is unknowable.
I had Brexit fatigue toward the end.
Oh,
when,
so did I.
When John Riley was sat there, I said to him, the best thing you've ever done recently is launch Sky News Brexit Free. Because actually, on a serious note, there was so much news that wasn't getting reported. Mm. And it was quite an interesting news programme. And then I'd watch the 10 to see, you know, all the Brexit stuff. But yeah. I mean, I've had Katia on. I used to say to her, you know, that was your, when you were being on the telly, that was my cue to go make a cup of tea. Because although I think she's a fantastic journalist, I just lost the will to live. One day one side was up, the other one the other side was down. And as I say, the only thing that I was looking forward to was death.
The thing is, though, with that Brexit story, what was so interesting about it, because I would wake up sometimes and think, oh, for goodness sake, you know, be nice to talk about something else.
Well, I said that to Katia yesterday. Have you had enough?
But I think that the extraordinary thing about Brexit, from the conversations I would have with just people, ordinary listeners and viewers, is that they would simultaneously say, I'm bored by it, but would then spend the next 15 minutes asking me questions about it. So I think it was possible in the height of the story last year for the same person at the same time to hold the view that they were bored by it, but they were riveted by it. Because we're all human beings and you can hold contradictory views at the same time about, you know, I'm bored by it because every time I turn the radio on, it's always Brexit. And I would think sometimes, oh, I'm talking about Brexit again. But at the same time, there has never been, and there'll probably never be, as compelling a period to report on politics as there was last year. Mm. Because, as I say, you never get a bigger moment in politics than when you don't know whether the government's going to survive the hour, the day, the week, the month, the year, or whether it's going to deliver on its central promise, particularly when that central promise is as something as significant as whether we stay in the European Union or leave it, which was a live question for much of last year.
It was incredible, really. I mean, I remember when Parliament voted against every single version of Brexit and no Brexit, and it was almost like some logic. I mean, if that was a Windows 95 computer, it would have blue-screened and just forced a reboot. Yeah. And I remember my wife turned to me, and she's an educated woman, and she follows politics at a normal level, I would say. Mm. She just looked at me and said, for goodness sake. And you know, I just thought, well, yeah, that's what a normal person would think.
Yeah,
where Parliament had brought itself into disrepute.
And what you've got now, I think, after the election, for the observers like me and for the participants, the politicians on all sides, is them adjusting to this new normal, majority government. But then the curiosity is that the new normal is the old normal.
This is threatening no-deal Brexit.
Well, there's all of that. But the bigger picture thing is that, you know, for advocates of the electoral system that we have, first past the post, one of the key cases they will make for it is that most of the time it delivers stable majority government.
Well, that's why I'm a reverse advocate.
And the history of it backs up that case.
An opponent.
You know, the history of the first past the post system in the Westminster system backs up the argument that says it usually delivers stable majority government.
And now it doesn't.
It didn't do for the last 10 years. But actually, you know, rewind over the last century and most of the time it's done it. And of course, what we're back to now is the old normal, which is you have an election and one party wins and has a clear majority and then governs for 4 or 5 years
and all strong government.
And then there's another election and, you know, and you see what happens. But the oddity is for the last 10 years, that's not been the case. And so all of the participants are having to adjust to this new thing where, bluntly, you know, stuff still matters and big arguments are still to be had and there's a vast amount that is still hugely newsworthy, but there isn't the jeopardy. Jeopardy's left the building. Mm. Because last year, any event at Westminster could plausibly have triggered the fall of the government.
I've got jeopardy fatigue. I don't care even if it's evil overlords that are running the country. Just give them 5 years to get on with it.
Well, I mean, journalists love Jeopardy because Jeopardy is what turbocharges a news story.
Absolutely.
Jeopardy is what gives a news story real bite and real spike.
Any tension, even if it's between people or tension in terms of uncertainty of outcome, it's tension. It's human stories that drive it.
Yeah.
And tension is the one thing that you need to tune in to find out what's going to happen next.
Equally, the flip side and the joy now for us in 2020 is the joy of the kind of the platter. The journalistic news platter is broader. You're not just dining out on the incredibly sweet, jammy Brexit donut of news, which we've been gorging on for the last 3 or 4 years. You've got the full buffet where you can suddenly start telling other news stories about this whole range of topics that matter to people, but for years, frankly, didn't get much airtime because we were all banging on about Brexit. So it's a great joy, actually, to be able to do that again.
Would you ever do another beat? I mean, because politics is in your blood. Would you ever do Simon Jack's job or Will Gompertz or someone where you'd have to complete? Because, I mean, that change might be something that might incredibly energise you. Yeah. You've done this for a long time.
Yeah, I have been tempted by that occasionally. And you know, I look at some beats, like the transport beat, for instance, there, you know, sort of toys getting to sit in a cockpit or in the cabin of a, or in the in front of the controls on a train.
Or the defence beat where you sat in the cockpit of a fighter
jet.
Yeah,
yeah. And I can see the appeal of that. But when I step back from it, I realise that kind of what makes me tick journalistically, and, you know, people may judge this positively or negatively, but I just love being on the air. And the easiest way to be on the air as often as possible is to cover politics. Because someone once said to me, and they're right, that the building over the road from our newsroom at 4 Millbank is Parliament. And this guy said to me, that place is the biggest news factory in the country because loads of stories come out of it. And every big story, even if it didn't start there, will come through it. So if there's a big thing that happens, well, anywhere in the UK, perhaps a little less so now with the devolved administrations, but basically any big story anywhere will get channeled through Westminster. So, you know, am I a leading authority on coronavirus? Clearly not. But has that story, which is in all likelihood as we record in at the beginning of March of 2020, going to be a story that...
You're out next week, don't we? We knew this would be topical.
Marvellous. You know,
and you jumped the queue of about 10 other people that we've got in the hopper
excellent.
Already.
Elbow them out of the way. The hopper, I like the idea of the hopper.
Oh, for my mental health, we have to have sort of 7 or 8 in the hopper, because then if I travel, I go away with work, the thought of running out of something would be horrendous.
The BBC has a euphemism for the hopper, which is called the shelf. And the reason it's a euphemism is because, you know, sometimes you'll do a recorded piece and people will say it's on the shelf. And it conjures up this image, doesn't it, of the trusty hardback that is there waiting to be picked off as a moment for the delectation of the reader. What I've discovered is that the shelf is a euphemism often for the bin.
Yes, exactly. And long may that continue.
Yeah, and occasionally stuff gets fished out of the bin and recycled, but quite often it ends up going down the chute and never to be seen again.
We have people that we think will be in the hopper for sort of a month or 6 weeks, and then it will be much more topical than we originally envisaged. Ah. You're the editor of an American business magazine who will talk about Trump for sort of half an hour, and that's great, but as he's saying it, I'm thinking, we're going to have to bring this forward in the release schedule now, and he's unwittingly, cut in line, and that's very, very clever. Now, listen, I've got a bone to pick with you. I'm from Yorkshire. I came to London to seek fame and fortune and be on the telly. Why have you succeeded and I haven't?
Well, I think you with your, you know, with your international globetrotting business and your tweeted pictures of Hollywood sunrises.
Yeah, but I'm not on the telly.
Well, so I it's curious, the London thing. Because I don't think I'll ever regard myself as a Londoner, even though I live and work here.
I don't regard myself as any. My dad would say he's a Yorkshireman.
Yeah, well, I think that.
Do you think you're a Yorkshireman?
I think I am. But I'm probably conscious that might occasionally mean that I'm sort of seen as a sort of professional Yorkshireman.
Who are the other Yorkshireman on air? I mean, you're properly on air. I'm just watching your podcast.
Well, funny enough, actually, the other day, someone, an old colleague in Yorkshire, a guy called Jonathan Cowap at BBC Radio York.
I used to go on his show. Jonathan was awesome.
So
he's awesome.
He messaged me, a direct message me on Twitter, because I'd noticed that three of us in a line on Radio 4 were all from Yorkshire, but he pointed out there was actually four of us. So I was sitting in Old Broadcasting House preparing to present...
OBH.
preparing to present any answers, the phone-in that follows any questions after the repeat on a Saturday lunchtime. Anita was away for the week, so I was doing the phone-in. And so it was that weird thing of hearing my own programme going out on the radio. Anyway, the news at 1 o'clock on that particular Saturday was read by Mark Forrest. Fantastic and incredibly versatile broadcaster who used to be on Virgin and Heart. And then he did the networked evening show on BBC Local Radio. He did the breakfast show on Classic FM for years. I mean, he has done every radio genre going. He now presents Drive Time on Scala. But in addition to that, he is a newsreader and continuity announcer on Radio 4. So he was reading the 1 o'clock news. He lives in Grinton, in Swaledale, and commutes down to London when he's doing his shifts.
Oh, he doesn't have, like, ISDN.
No, he does, and he does his Scala show from his from his sort of back bedroom. But he does, when he does a Radio 4 presenting shift, he's down here doing it. So he was reading the news, and then Dominic Busby was reading the sport, fantastic sports broadcaster, also a Yorkshireman. Then Nick Miller was doing the weather. Now, I didn't realise that Nick was a Yorkshireman. I think, is it York or Scarborough? I'm not quite sure. I think he's from York. And then I was presenting any questions. So it was a
we're taking over.
It was a quartet. It was a quartet of Yorkshiremen, which is absolutely, absolutely terrific. But yeah, I mean, I honestly find myself, and even having this conversation with you and being on your podcast, given the kind of cast list of people that you've had on, I still find myself regularly kind of pinching myself and thinking, you know, how did this happen and will it all end tomorrow? And, you know, when will I get found out and all that kind of stuff. That happens. That, you know, that self-doubt thing never goes away. And I think, to be honest, it would be a bad thing if it ever did. You know, you're constantly trying to remove
it. Keeps you sharp.
Because it keeps you sharp.
And you can't be complacent.
No, exactly. And you know, there's always another generation coming and there's people who are trying different stuff. And I'm always conscious that, you know, what might make me seem fresh to some people could very easily seem stale. So, you know, you're constantly thinking about what do you do next and how do you refresh and how do you keep yourself engaged and engaging? Because that's the game.
Many, many years ago in the dim and distant past, I made a few bad business decisions and went bankrupt, moved to London, absolutely had nothing. And it taught me two things. One is, it's not as bad as you think. It's obviously bad. You've got no money, but it's not going to kill you and you can learn a lot from it. And then two, it's taught me a very, very healthy fear of I ain't ever going back there ever again.
Yeah.
And I actually think that drives me forward. I don't take any of our clients for granted, even ones that we've had for many years. Mm. And that's not me saying it in some generic platitude way, like an American, you know, business coach. I truly fear being fired in a positive way because I think, you know, that guy's happy now. He's 7 months away from firing us, though, if we don't plant the seeds now. So let's get on with it.
Completely. And so the other night we did Any Questions in Sunderland. And so I started my career in the northeast of England with the BBC. And I invited along my first BBC news editor, a guy called Tony Jones, who's a massive, massive influence on me. And he was in the audience, which immediately made me want to raise my game. But he, I remember, once had this fantastic saying about broadcasting, which I have never, touch wood, gently so it doesn't rattle the microphone. Paul's already told me off, dear listener.
Yeah, there's been
tapping the wood too much.
There's been a few hand gestures from me saying stop tapping the table, hasn't there?
Anyway, he once had this line. And I think it's the broadcasting equivalent of what you've just said, which is both a reassuring line, but it also keeps you on the money. And he said, in broadcasting, your best stuff isn't as good as you think it is, and your worst stuff isn't as bad. And I have, and my goodness, I've done some turkeys, but I have never known that rule to be broken. When you listen back to something that you think was dire, and you think, yeah, it was pretty bad, but it wasn't as bad as I thought. Mm. Equally, when you listen back to something, you think, I absolutely nailed that. That was fantastic. And you listen back and you think, well, it was all right, but it came and went. And it was ephemeral because broadcasting is wonderfully ephemeral. And it kind of just goes. And I've never, touch wood, known that to be broken. And the great thing about that is that you always think it's about the next. You're only as good as your last piece, but the most important piece is your next one.
I remember the first time I went on air on a big news show, I thought I was going to die just before I went on air. Like, genuinely, not even nerves like I might die, as in I literally might collapse on air. It was Live at Five, Jeremy Thompson, of course, who is like, he's like the Kent Brockman, isn't he? I mean, he was proper male, butch, proper, really good journalist.
And Bruce Hamill, the voice of Trans World Sport when I was growing up, would be doing those thumping intros that he used to do, you know, live from the Sky News Centre.
I know.
Presenter of the year, Jeremy Thompson.
Voiceover was sort of... you know, intimidating. But yeah. I was waiting in the wings. I was mic'd up, and I thought my mum's watching this. I'm just gonna have to get through it and not appear nervous. Mm. And I didn't have a clue what I said. I was there for sort of. So the report ran, and I'm being taken to the desk, and then he's sort of pleasant and everything as you'd expect. And then he just turns to me and asks me the question. And honestly, I just thought I've just got to get through this Daniel Bedingfield style. Do you know what I mean? And I honestly can't remember anything that I said, but it's on YouTube. And I look back now, and it was nowhere near as terrible as I thought it was.
In fact,
he kind of, because I could see over his shoulder that the producer had prepared like a brief, and he hadn't read it because he's Jeremy Thompson. He kind of thought, so his questions were nowhere near as good as the ones that the producers had actually planned, and that helped me. But I was almost slightly taken aback by that. And then, of course, as ever on telly, sort of 4 minutes, he then says, Paul, thank you for coming in. Mm. Turns to the camera and starts reading the autocue again. Mm. And I thought, is that it? Have I just come down to London for that? It was unbelievable. And then I do a lot of Jeremy Vine. And again, it was nerves. But now it's not about nerves. It's about delivering a good performance.
Yeah.
But you do get a slight twitch.
Oh, you do, and you would never want to lose that. So the great joy with assembling those air miles as a broadcaster.
Malcolm Gladwell calls them the 10,000 hours.
I buy that. I buy that argument. I think that book is really powerful. Matthew Syed of The Times has written a brilliant book called Bounce. They've got the myth of talent and the power of practice. Mm. And I think that's such a powerful argument. It's practice. It's air miles. Air miles, air miles, air miles. You know, it's the whole idea that, you know, it's not that the pilot who's been flying planes for 30 years is somehow innately more talented at it than the guy who's just joined flight school. It's that he's done 30 more years, isn't it? That's the thing.
Interestingly, when I was 16, I started parachute jumping, and the instructor said to me, he said, the danger zone is between 300 and 500 jumps, because you've had successful jumps 300 times in a row and you've packed your parachute, and little shortcuts start to seep in, and none of them in isolation will be a problem, but the 7 different slight shortcuts of packing your parachute, the day that you do all 7 at once, your parachute doesn't open properly.
Well, that's where I fear I am with any questions at the moment. So I've been doing it for about 5 or 6 months. So
I'm doing
it
very well, by the way.
Well, thank you.
I might say, as a listener.
Well, it's a joy. It's an absolute joy to do it. But, you know, when I did my first few, I was petrified.
You didn't sound it, genuinely.
Oh, well, thank you, but I was, believe you me. I was slightly feared that, you know, the sound of my heart throbbing would be audible to the
back
listener.
Back to me going on Jeremy Thompson again. Just thinking, I just need to survive this.
Exactly, but the one thing with that survival instinct is that, yes, you might be a little sort of flatter than your true self, but because you've got the sort of broadcasting equivalent of being chased by a lion, your entire focus is on avoiding being eaten. When you are, as I am, sort of 16, 17 programmes in, you're at that same stage, I guess, as the parachutist who is still not very experienced, but is considerably more experienced than they were at the start. So the danger is, I'm conscious of this every week at the moment, the danger is I think to myself, well, I've done this for quite a few times now, I kind of know what I'm doing. Well, not really. I mean, I've done 17 shows. My predecessor did 32 years. Mm. I mean, I'm not even... I'm about.
We've got him coming on as well, actually.
Oh, fantastic. You should have had it. I could have done with having him on before me. I could have listened to him to
we
work out
how
he's
before done. And after. It was like a baton handing at the end.
He was wonderfully generous in his expertise. I could have listened to him forever.
We work with a stage fright consultant, because we work with a lot of chief executives of global businesses. And the one thing that... We get them in the room while they're preparing for a big speech without them asking, because one of the things that these alpha male leaders can't admit is that actually a big problem is, how do you manage your nerves to a big speech?
Yeah.
And you know, you give a TED talk and you suddenly you're out of nowhere and you there's going to be 1.5-2 million people watching it.
Mm.
And the first thing is, they're going to crap themselves.
Yeah.
So this stage fright consultant has like visualization techniques, but ultimately it's about breathing exercise.
Mm.
It's about starting a sentence and forcing yourself through discipline to remind yourself to take a big breath in so that you don't run out of breath.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
You take shallow breaths when you're nervous.
Oh, completely. And I think the thing I'm always struck by is that the longer someone like me does a job like the one I do, the easier it is to forget that when I'm presenting an edition of Any Questions or any other kind of presenting or interviewing, presenting on the breakfast sofa, you're going to encounter people for whom, well, it's your moment with Jeremy Thompson.
It's a pretty
where they've
big deal.
Never done it before. And it will be the big moment of their day, their week, maybe even the month. Particularly in these days where there's no such thing as an obscure broadcast slot because it ends up on YouTube or whatever. So you're always conscious of reminding yourself. We had someone on Any Questions the other day who'd never done the programme before and has done very little broadcasting. Most people who come on Any Questions are fairly established in the whole business of talking to journalists, because people in politics is kind of part of the job description. But this guy was the chief executive of a ports company, never been on, had no idea about the programme and all the rest of it. He was brilliant, but I was very conscious that it was very, very new for him, and he'd be having all of those anxieties that you were having and that I had when I first sat on the breakfast sofa and all of that. And it's my job to try and put him at his ease so that he gives the best version of himself. Of course, I'm going to scrutinise his position and all the rest of it, but it's in our mutual interest that he is as comfortable as possible in terms of the environment that he's in, and he can give the sort of best case for his argument. I'll scrutinise his argument. It's not my job to agree or disagree with his argument. It's my job to scrutinise it. But it's also my job to make him feel comfortable in the environment that we've invited him into. Why? Because A, common courtesy, and B, because he'll give a better performance.
I also think the audience are more forgiving than you think. I mean, one of the things I was nervous about is that people would somehow sneer at me. But a lot of my friends and a lot of people, you know, a lot of real people I see on the news, if they're slightly nervous, I think that's a good thing. It shows respect and reverence, as long as it doesn't utterly debilitate them.
Completely.
I think most people in the audience and watching at home and listening are quite forgiving of these things.
I think that's absolutely the case. And the thing I'll always say to people when they are coming on live, because people are always paranoid about coming on live because they imagine that they're suddenly going to sort of blurt out something that's going to make them look stupid, is that I often say to them, what's your biggest sort of fear about journalists? And people will say often, oh, they'll take me out of context. And I say, well, look, you're on live, so that's impossible.
Exactly.
I said, you might kick yourself afterwards that the thing you really wanted to say, you forgot to say.
But you're not share, you can't turn back time.
But you know, so be aware of that. And I said, I'll also be aware that it'll pass by in the blink of an eye. But I said, I can't take you out of context because every word you utter will be broadcast. Now, I get that that's quite nerve-wracking if you've never broadcast before, but ultimately, you will only, the listener or the viewer will only see or hear what it is that you choose to say.
I mean, we work with some media trainers as well, and one of the problems that alpha male butch global chief executives have is that when they're being media trained, partly through vanity and arrogance and ego, they assume that every journalist is going to grill them at a kind of Jeremy Paxman-esque level of intensity that only the Prime Minister would get. Mm. And frankly, they're not sufficiently interesting. Of course, they, like you say, they're going to have a light grilling. It's going to be direct and respectful, but it's not going to be that jousting battle of wits that frankly a lot of media trainers pretend that they're going to get, so they can then do 2 days media training at $5,000 a day rather than one. So it is a bit of a racket, really.
Yeah, not least because I always think, you know, irrespective of what somebody is coming on to say, if they come across as human, the likelihood of them relating to the audience is vastly greater. So one of my obsessions on Any Questions or any kind of broadcasting I'm doing is, it's the responsibility of the interviewer, in my view, for the interviewee to be seen in three dimensions. You know, the nature sometimes of broadcast news when you're doing a couple of minutes of a news report is that, you know, a politician in particular will be seen in one dimension. You know, person X is a Brexiteer or is a Remainer or is a Labour hardliner or whatever. You know, these kind of labels that get thrown around people. And it's not that those labels are inaccurate, but that person will be a more rounded individual than that. Everybody is three-dimensional. And particularly on a programme like Any Questions, if I fail to give people a chance to portray themselves in three dimensions, then I have failed. Because this is a programme which is all about people being able to talk extensively about an argument. So I want to know not just what someone thinks, but why they think it. Now, that may or may not change the mind of the listener as far as that particular politician is concerned, but it should mean that, firstly, it's a more engaging listen because you're engaging them with them on a human level, and secondly, that the listener has a greater understanding of why that person has that point of view, whether they share that view or not. So stepping away from that kind of perhaps inevitable caricaturing that goes on in either the sort of traditional two-minute news report or sometimes in the, my own view, slightly old-fashioned way of political interviewing that is hugely kind of gladiatorial and very kind of in your face. I'm just not sure now that that is a particularly productive way of carrying out a conversation.
Is it a different skill set chairing a panel of politicians? Because, like, I know you were lightheartedly joking about when you were just stuck on the BBC breakfast sofa, but you know there is a skill to chairing a panel. I've done it in the past, or were you just kind of just put in the chair and then left to get on with it? Because chairing a panel of politicians or chairing a panel of anyone is a slightly different skill set than, you know, having a straight two-way or straight journalism. Yeah. Were you giving any training?
No. It is a different skill set.
BBC's flagship radio show is just like you just plonked on these various things.
No. So it is a different skill set, and yeah, I'm sort of learning on the job, really. So what had I done prior to doing Any Questions? Well, I'll tell you what I hadn't done. I had never once presented a live programme with a live panel in front of a live audience, which is a pretty pithy description of what Any Questions is.
Yeah,
I'd never done that.
That's literally what it is.
So I'd presented, you know, a lot of radio shows as a stand-in on the World Service on 5 Live on Radio 4, which I'd loved. But I'd never depped on any questions, so I'd never stood in for Jonathan. I didn't do any of the depping in the gap between Jonathan finishing and me starting. So the only thing that I'd done that was even vaguely like it was a couple of Brexit casts that we'd done in front of a studio audience, but the format's very different, not least because there's four presenters. So the only thing that I'd done that was close to it was my audition to get the job, which was the most nerve-wracking bit of broadcasting I did last year, and it wasn't even broadcast. It was just in the radio theatre at Broadcasting House, one lunchtime where people had been bribed in, I think, with the prospect of pizza.
So there were real people?
Well, there were real people, but most of them were on their lunch break from BBC people.
Yeah.
I kept looking into the audience. And of course, you know, when you're on a stage and it's lit and the audience isn't really lit, you know, you can't really see. I'd look into the audience. There'd be someone, you know, I think, hang on, there's a bloke there with a clipboard. And I think, hang on, he's a senior manager, isn't he? You know?
Does MBH get much footfall? I don't think it does. I mean, that Costa that's in the
it's all full of BBC staffers.
So, yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we had a proper panel. It was a stellar panel. It'd been a panel you could have put on any actual edition.
A real panel of
politicians. We had, who did we have on? We had Michael Forsyth of Tory PM, who we've since had on since I've started the programme.
And why were they doing that? As a favour to
I've always wondered that. You know, I've always wondered that. Yeah, I mean, bluntly, they were doing it as a favour. If I was to hear a trail on Radio 4 that said, starting next week, Michael Forsyth, this 27-part series on the, you know, Scottish Canal Network.
Yeah, I'd listen to that.
I'd think, you know, altruism has its benefits. But no, to be fair, I mean,
evil BBC quid pro quo.
They were very public-spirited. So Michael Forsyth and Charlie Faulkner, Lord Faulkner.
I've always
and
liked Charlie.
And then Giesler Stewart, former Labour MP, and Bronwyn Maddox of Prospect magazine. Oh, is she now at the Institute for Government? I think she is. Anyway, they were all on, very weighty and very noble and public-spirited of them to do this discussion. Not least because they had to do it three times because there was three of us in the last round of the
selection. Oh, you're allowed to say who the other two were. Is it public knowledge?
It would be ungentlemanly of me to do so.
Indeed.
So
discretion is the better part of valour.
It rarely is a journalist, is that true? But in this instance, I think it probably is.
So tell us about Newscast then. Isn't it just Brexit cast with a different name? It's the same people. The same old stuff.
Yeah. It's
why should anyone listen?
Well, what it's going to be...
That was my attempt at hard journalism.
Yeah, it's going to be is... So our kind of view was, when the UK left the European Union, was that whilst there'd be loads of Brexit still in the news, it wouldn't be as all-consuming as it was last year. And that maybe on this podcast we should talk about some other stuff as well, as we had during the election when we rebranded it as ElectionCast, which is what it had been called in the first place before it morphed into BrexitCast. And so we thought, what are we going to call it? Newscast, we thought we would go for. And so we will
present a podcast that's more popular than this one.
Well, it is for now. I think you're going to overtake us in time.
Oh,
I think we're going to tumble back into the obscurity from which we started.
We both know that's not going to be true. But anyway, I interrupted.
So Newscast is going to become a daily thing, or at least a weekday thing. I don't know if it'll be 7 days, but it'll certainly be a daily thing.
Are you going to collapse of a heart attack?
No, well, I won't do it every day. I won't do it every day. I'll definitely do it on a Thursday. Because on Thursday is this day when we have this incredible twist where the newscast is on, where the podcast is on the telly, which is a joyful thing. I mean, we were slightly nervous when BBC One came knocking because this week was coming off the air, and BBC One, I think, thought, well, we could keep a late night politics slot that'll be a damn sight cheaper because it's just a podcast with some cameras.
It's why panel shows are so popular because, you know, if you think of how much Downton Abbey costs for an hour.
Yeah, versus
Have I Got News For You? Yeah, they might give 50 grand a piece to Paul Merton and, you know, Ian Hislop, but it's still much cheaper telly, prime time.
And Newscast is infinitely cheaper still. But when we were invited on the telly, I mean, we were flattered to be asked, but our big fear was two things. One, that it might be just rubbish and, you know, you can be your own judge as to whether that's come to pass. But the second thing is we thought we could kill the podcast because we thought our audience might think, oh, they've turned into telly tarts. Now, I know we are telly tarts in the rest of our sort of professional lives.
But it is a podcast with a camera because you are still wearing cans and...
Oh, completely. Exactly. And our view was that it will succeed if we don't irritate our established podcast listeners. So we always talk about... So, for instance, if we talk into a clip of the Prime Minister, we will say on the podcast, let's listen to Boris Johnson, because that works if you're watching, but it works if you're listening. Whereas if you say, let's have a look at Boris Johnson, the podcast listener thinks, telly tart. So we're always conscious of keeping the Brexit casters, as we called them, election casters, newscasters, our core podcast audience, happy. And you know what? We've never had, none of us, we all talk about this, we've never had a more fulfilling experience in terms of the connection with the audience than we had with Brexitcast and we've got with Newscast now, where that demand-led broadcasting, people would say during the height of the Brexit process, oh, are you going to sound the klaxon tonight, which was this thing we had for when we did an emergency one, i.e. something other than the weekly Thursday
edition. I'm a listener.
And, you know, to get that...
They were coming thick and fast at one point.
Yeah, they were.
Well.
And to get that kind of demand... Fatigue. Yeah, that demand-led thing. And then people saying, oh, I haven't been listening, but I've gone back through the, you know, I've gone back through the whole thing to catch up. And the wonderful thing was that sense that we were reaching a different audience. So an audience that might not instinctively turn on the 10 o'clock news or turn on the Today programme, particularly a younger audience. That is a wonderful thing. You know, somebody on the train. I was going to Sunderland the other day and I was queuing for the toilet on the train.
It's not all glamour, is it?
No, and the woman who came out of the, you know, pressed the button, beep, 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 and the door opens. She came out of the toilet and immediately stuck her hand out. I hope she'd washed her hands. Anyway, she immediately stuck her hand out.
She could be patient zero.
Yeah, yeah. And she said, "Guys, you're Chris from Brexitcast, aren't you?" At least she didn't think I was the person who emptied the septic tank. And then we had a conversation about the podcast. And, you know, that happens sometimes about doing stuff on the telly or doing stuff on the radio. But the connection you have with a podcast audience is turbocharged. And I think it's two reasons. One is people have actively chosen to click on Media Masters and press go.
Very few of them, I might add.
No, your stellar audience are consuming every podcast other than this one, which they might skip over. But not only that, but most people are listening to podcasts straight into their head, pumped in by their little white earphones, straight into their head. So that's two reasons why it's that turbocharged personal experience.
You and couldn't do this with if it was only 10 minutes. People do listen to it sometimes across two or three runs.
Yeah, because it's extensive, isn't it? It's properly extensive. Because you would never have this type of interview, you know, on the radio or on the telly. Because
there's just not enough time.
No, there isn't. And also because when you are broadcasting, it has to be quite broad. The joy of podcasting is that it can be a bit more narrow, it can be a bit more niche. But with that, you have that incredibly powerful connection with the audience, which is wonderful. I mean, that's what as broadcasters you live to try and achieve.
So last question then. You know, what's next? I've seen loads of Bond films where the villain ultimately ends up with a hollowed out volcano in the middle of the Pacific and a load of henchmen and a monorail to get the henchmen around the volcano. You know, is it outer space that you're going to dominate? What is next for you? Are you going to present the 10 o'clock news, Director General of the BBC? Are you going to do an Alan Yentob and turn exec?
No.
Today programme, that seems to be the, I wasn't say graveyard, but that's the wrong, a very, very fruitful graveyard. What is it? Come on, tell us.
So I'm not going to be exec. I can definitely tell you. I mean,
so you're always going to be airside?
Yes. I think it was John Simpson who talked about how there's the sort of division in broadcasting between the power and the glory. And I think he put both of those in inverted commas, because just occasionally when you're standing on College Green in the rain.
Because I've seen a lot of The Sopranos, but if you poison Fiona Bruce's tea, you could make it look like an accident, and then there'd be a vacancy there. You'd get question time, and then Hugh could die in a freak skiing accident or something because you've tampered with his skis, and then you could present everything.
So I've got, look, I have got all sorts of
I imagined a lot of senior BBC presenters' deaths there, didn't I, as a preamble to a question. I apologise to both of them.
I wish them all good health.
As do I.
Wish them all good health. Yeah. So I've got, I mean, you know, I'm very ambitious. I've got all sorts of ludicrous ambitions. I mean, at the moment, my sole ambition is to go back to your line about the person with the 300 parachute jumps, is to not become the first Any Questions presenter to be fired within 10 months. Because the curiosity is it's a programme with a heritage of more than 70 years and it's only had five named presenters.
And it clearly weighs on you.
I mean, I'm number five. It flipping does. You know, when the previous guy has the surname Dimbleby and did the job for 32 years, I mean, talk about... I mean, the most famous surname in British broadcast news since broadcasting was invented. And I'm the next guy. And he did it for 32 years. So, you know, getting better at doing Any Questions by air miles, that is the number one ambition. And that's a big ambition because I take nothing for granted.
You could do
really
33
big...
years and then stand down.
Yeah.
And then go and visit his grave and say, I will feel
sort of infinitely more experienced at it when I've done 32 programmes because I've done sort of 15, 16, 17 at the moment. And I will be infinitely more experienced because I'll have done double the number that I currently have. So in that sense, that is, and I know that sounds like I'm dodging the question, but that is absolutely my ambition. What else do I want to do?
The Andrew Marr show would be the best one, wouldn't it? Sunday morning, the big ticket politicians.
There's so many. I mean, frankly, just reading, I say just, it's a massive thing just to, you know, reading the news bulletin on the Andrew Marr show, let alone the rest of it. What do I want to do? I want to carry on broadcasting every day, which is what I get to do in this job. I want to carry on telling good stories well. Paul B in time, I want to do more presenting. But as I say, I need to get better at the day job presenting, i.e. any questions first. Let's learn to crawl before you can walk and walk before you can run. Firm believer in doing all of that. But then just trying to make the most of, you know, I always look beyond the BBC and keep an eye on what else is going on.
Treat them mean to keep them keen.
Yeah, but equally, make the most of the best toy box in news broadcasting, which, you know, right now is the BBC, and trying to get to do as much exciting stuff as I can. And the stuff I wouldn't have believed a year ago that I'd be doing what I'm doing now, because a year ago I didn't know that Jonathan was about to stand down from any questions and so the vacancy was going to come up.
And Does it come up on like the intranet or something? Did he see it on an email?
So I'll tell you what happened. So he announced and it was made public that he was standing down. He was going to retire from any questions. And I didn't really think much about it. And then about a month later, I was bathing my daughter on a Friday night and I turned the radio on in the bathroom because I'm one of those nerds who's got a radio in every room. So I turned on the radio in the bathroom.
Do you have a Sonos?
No, I'm a bit. I have just got one of those speaker things that you talk to, but I'm still. I mean, that might.
No, Sonos is like a linked network.
Oh, that linked.
We have them in every house, in every room.
Every house, on every continent. Yeah. Yes,
yeah. In every room. It's awesome, and you can link them up as well.
Oh, wow. I can turn my radio on and then I can turn it off.
Anyway, I've got this little.
It's a waterproof radio, this. So this is the height of technology. Anyway, I discovered it. I got it to put it in the shower, but there's no good having a radio actually physically in the shower, I've discovered, because you put your head under to wash your hair and you can't hear it.
No, I agree.
So it still works. But
you have to do it so loud that it wakes up the rest of the house.
Yeah, exactly right. So anyway, it's there. So I turned it on this Friday night. And it's fair to say, I hadn't intended to have Radio 4 on. I was going to put magic on or whatever. I turn on the radio and Any Questions is on. And I suddenly thought, as I was listening to it, I thought, oh, yeah, Jonathan said he's going, isn't it? And I thought, I was just listening to him, you know, joshing with the panel and interacting with the audience.
I could do that.
I thought this would be fun. And then I thought, yeah, but Chris, you idiot, you know, if he announced a month ago that he was standing down, he probably told the bosses about 2 years ago.
And
the whole thing, it'd all be sorted. Anyway, having put my daughter to bed, I thought it was sort of bugging me. And I thought, well, what do I do about this? Because in all likelihood, it's not going to be advertised because these things rarely are. So, but I don't even know who I would ask.
Any questions at bbc.co.uk?
Yeah. So I emailed a BBC boss and just said, well, all of the things I've just said out loud. You know, I'm sure this is a done deal already. I'm sure I'd be number 793 in the queue. But, you know, if there is a queue and there is a vacancy, then I'd be quite keen.
I'd love to know who that was. You could tell me off air.
But it was a guy called Gavin Allen who used to run BBC Westminster. Yeah. Who's now a senior executive in BBC News. And I just emailed him because I know him and he's a very sort of human, approachable kind of guy. And I thought, you know what, he'll reply. He might tell me that it's nothing to do with him or that it's all sorted and they picked someone or that I haven't got hope in hell. But he'll reply. Anyway, so I emailed him. And, you know, we went for a coffee and all the rest of it. Anyway, then nothing kind of happened. And then I got an email from a BBC exec saying, oh, you know, we're speaking to various people who we might be interested in this process. You know, do you want to come for a coffee? And I went for a coffee. And then I went for various other coffees, which is curious because you realise that these coffees that you've arranged are effectively, you're arranging your own job interviews to an extent, except it's happening in Costa rather than in some airless basement in Broadcasting House. And then it became a kind of quasi process. So we had to do a written submission. So it was never advertised in a sort of here it is on the internet. But those of us who by that stage were talking to the execs, I don't know how many of us there were. Maybe there weren't any others. Maybe that's why I ended up together. There were a few others. Anyway.
Well, was at least two others that you were
trying to see. There was a few others. And I think some people they approached, didn't want it, which is probably from my perspective a good thing because they might otherwise have been given it. But we had to do a written submission, you know, what you make of the programme and what you do with it and blah, blah, blah. So you do all of that. Then we got called in for this audition where people were bribed with pizza or whatever to come in and, hecklers and all the rest of it. Yeah, and then I was stood outside a health centre. In fact, I wasn't stood. I was sat in the car outside a health centre in Plumstead in southeast London. Anyway, the phone rings, and it's it's a mobile number, but not one that I've got the name of the person. Take it. And it is Mohit, who is the controller of Radio 4.
Wow.
And I thought, well, this is interesting, because I don't think he'd be ringing up the people who he's not going to give the job to. Anyway, it's all this classic thing, isn't it, when someone like that, it doesn't happen very often for me, but anyway, it's all these sort of pleasantries and always, you know, oh, nice
weather.
I just said,
look, spill the beans, Mohit.
Anyway, he then offers me the job, and I just couldn't, I was just sort of,
well,
Mohit,
the short answer is, yes, I'd be delighted to take it.
Which is exactly what I said. And then I sort of... I did one of those things where you put the phone down and sort of go, yeah, and sort of punch the air and sort of, I couldn't believe it. I was delighted. I was excited. I was exhilarated.
Deservedly so.
And it's wonderful. And it did feel like, and I said this on my first programme, like clambering in awe onto the shoulders of giants, doing a programme where the likes of Jonathan Dimbleby and David Jacobs. I've met some of David's relatives actually since, who came along to a programme we did in Cornwall, which was hugely humbling. You know, the history of the programme with, as I say, David Jacobs and John Timpson and Freddie Griswood. And you just think, God, blimey, my name's on that list. And then just theory, just being conscious that you've been handed this temporary custody of this sort of broadcasting Ming vase and you don't want to smash it.
Chris, we're going to have to go, and this is a compliment to you, but this has been the longest ever Media Masters we've ever done.
My goodness. Well,
that's testament to what a great guest you've been. Thank you ever so much.
Thanks
I really,
for having me.
Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Paul.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.